We're now going to read from the Bible in John chapter 21. John chapter 21. Afterwards, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, also known as Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. "I'm going out to fish," Simon Peter told them. And they said, "We'll go with you." So they went out and got into the boat. But that night they caught nothing. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. He called out to them, "Friends, haven't you any fish?" "No," they answered. He said, "Throw your net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some." When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Then the disciples whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, "It is the Lord," he wrapped his outer garment round him, for he had taken it off, and jumped into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from the shore, about 100 meters. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish in it and some bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you have just caught." So Simon Peter climbed back into the boat and dragged the net ashore. It was full of large fish, 153. But even with so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." None of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread, and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said, "you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." Again, Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." A third time, he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my sheep. Very truly, I tell you, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go." Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, "Follow me." High points and low points are most definitely part of life. Now, at a flippant level, those of you who follow football teams know that the pundits would call it the business end of the season. Now, if you follow a football team, you know what it is to have highs, cup wins, and you know what it is to have lows when there's a possibility of relegation or whatever. Now, you know what I always say to myself if I get too emotionally involved with football? This does not affect my life, but I still follow it all the same. And you know, highs and lows are also part of our Christian experience. So many characters in the Bible experience these things. We know the story of Elijah. We know the story of his victories, particularly the victory on Mount Carmel against the prophets of Baal, where he cried to the Lord, and the Lord answered with fire. And the people said, "The Lord, He is God." It was a day of great victory. But then Jezebel hears about it. And she is really annoyed at this. And she threatens to kill Elijah. And he takes off and he finds a broom tree. And he says, "It's enough. I want to die." So what happens? Within a matter of days, there's a high and a low. How did he get to that place? How do we get to that place when we've had highs in our Christian life? We find ourselves so low because we can find ourselves in that place. Another occasion I think of is the Israelites when they've left Egypt and they're being pursued and they come to the Red Sea. They think, "Oh, we've had it now. We've got this army behind us. We've got marshes to the right. We've got the sea before us." And Moses said, "Fear not, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord." And we know the story how God opened up the sea for them and they crossed on dry land. And then there's the song, the psalm that they sang, "The Lord is our strength and song. He's become our salvation." And there's great joy. There's Miriam with her tambourine. And it's a high. They travel away from the Red Sea. About 3 days into the desert, they're short of water. They begin to complain. And then they come to this pool, and there's a bit of hope. It's a pool called Marah. And when they take the water, they discover that the water is bitter. And they're low. They're really, really low. They've come to a place of bitterness. And again, we can come to that place. I was reading Ruth earlier this morning, and in Ruth chapter 1, Naomi returned from Moab to Judea, and she's bereft of her husband and her two sons, and she said, "Call me not Naomi, but Mara," because it was a bitter time in her life. And we get to these places, and you know, when I think about Mara, you know, Mara is a place not to stop, but to keep going, because just further along there was Elim. Was it 12 springs of water, 70 palm trees? God had refreshment planned for them just along the road if they would persevere here. Well, in Peter particularly, we soon become aware of the highs and lows. Sometimes he had highs and lows in very quick succession. The disciples are on board a boat. It's stormy. Jesus comes to them walking on the water. And they recognize that it's the Lord. And Peter says, "Lord, if it's you, ask me to come to you walking in the water." And Jesus said, "Come." And Peter walks in the water. It's a high moment. But then he looks around at the raging sea, at the wind, and beginning to sink, he calls upon the Lord. It's a low moment, and the Lord stretches out his hand and lifts him up. And the thing I always remember from that passage is that Peter, when he was just beginning to sink, he cried to the Lord. Sometimes we leave it a while and think we'll do it on our own, but beginning to sink, at that point, he immediately cried in the Lord, and the Lord took his hand and lifted him up. He also had highs and lows over longer periods, didn't he? Because at Caesarea Philippi, people were asking, "Who's Jesus? Who do people say I am?" And some said John the Baptist, some Elijah, some Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. And Jesus turned to Peter and said, "Who do you say I am?" And he said, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. Blessed are you, Simon, son of John, for man has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." It was a high moment. But then time passes. I've already alluded to Peter in the courtyard. And he's followed Jesus thus far. "Aren't you one of his disciples? Don't you know Jesus?" A maid asks him and others ask him. And he says, "No, I never knew Jesus." And he denies that he knew Jesus. And so the great confessor has become the great repudiator. Perhaps you've had such a low moment in your life, some point when you failed Jesus. I have. Peter's very low moment is part of the context of today's story in John 21. It's seen as a breakfast meeting with Jesus beside the sea after he'd helped the disciples with their fishing. It was a difficult moment for all the disciples, but especially Peter. The Lord had already shown himself to Peter after his resurrection, but until now, not a word had passed between them. Peter had not spoken to Jesus, and Jesus had not spoken directly to Peter. The matter of Peter's denial of Jesus hasn't been mentioned, neither by Jesus nor Peter. And I'm not sure that Peter had even told the disciples. You can decide on that. They certainly knew later on. But how Peter must have longed to speak to his Lord privately, to confess his shame and beg forgiveness, but the Lord had not allowed it as yet. Now Christ is alone with Peter, at some distance from the other disciples. Was he out of their hearing? Was he in their hearing? Again, you can decide on that. But it's Jesus who opens the conversation. How will he deal with Peter's sin? Well, we soon discover that the message of John 21, 15 to 17 is direct, yet loving and forgiving. We're wonderfully assured that failure is not the end, despite Satan's attempt to say it is. Now, this period was a very dark period because, in a sense, Jesus had been going to the cross, and this was part of the Father's plan. And when Judas came, he said, this is your hour and the power of darkness. And when Jesus had spoken to Peter earlier, he said, Simon, Simon, Satan has desired to have you to sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you. So he had a bit of involvement there. But Jesus brought Peter to a place of new beginning. He perseveres with all his children. And if we speak of the perseverance of the saints, we must also be cognizant of the perseverance of God. God is in the restoration business. David wrote in Psalm 23, he restores my soul. And he knew what it was to be restored and refreshed physically and also at times spiritually, sadly. And so John 21 is a passage that reminds us that spiritual restoration will be needed by all of us at some time. And John 21 has special relevance for any weighed down by some failure in the past, whether it be recent or a long time ago. It may be that a burden has been carried, and on account of that burden, it may be keeping you in the sidelines, and yet you long to be near. We might be wrestling with our past. We might be worrying about our future. We might be failing to enjoy our present, on account of the need of spiritual restoration. There was a time when Psalm 40 rang so true in our hearts. He put a new song in my heart, even praise to our God. Many will see it and fear and trust in the Lord. He drew me out of a horrible pit, out of the mire and slime, and set my feet on a rock and established my going. And we rejoice to sing and vocalize these words. And maybe something happened along the way. You're still rejoicing. You're still in the company of God's people. But a failure, maybe only known to us, has affected us. God may want to speak to some of us today about spiritual restoration. Jesus has a healing, renewing, rehabilitating ministry. And we can learn from the way he dealt with Peter. The steps in the process of restoration are still used by him. And I want us to think, first of all, about gentle reminders that we can see here. Before there can be restoration, there must be awareness of the gravity of our sin and waywardness. Peter's waywardness is recorded in all the Gospels, the sad details of his denial, the events that prompted the need for restoration. Now, notice Jesus doesn't begin by flaying Peter verbally with the details of his denial. And sometimes it's just not the right thing to flay people verbally. You see, he is the master of meaningfulness, and skillfully he sets a stage that will speak for itself. First of all, there was a charcoal fire. As the fire glowed there in the pre-dawn light, it was a vivid reminder of the other fire where Peter had warmed himself just before his denial in the high priest's courtyard. It's very vivid. When I was a young person, one of the things that young people used to do, maybe they still do it today, is they would have barbecues. And the favorite location for a barbecue was Loughton Telchig. And I remember being up Loughton Telchig. There was a crowd of folks there that night, a crowd of young people. It was a very quiet, still sort of night. And there was a speaker there, a very good speaker. And he asked us this question. He says, "Are you warming yourself at the fires of the world?" I'd never forgotten that. And I thought about it. You know, the fire spoke volumes that night. The fire must have spoken volumes to Peter, mustn't it? And then the second reminder was the threes. Three times Peter had denied Jesus. Three times Jesus asked him about his love for him. To be questioned three times was grieving to Peter, but the terrible persistence of his denial must be brought home to him. There was a threefold denial, and now the opportunity for a threefold affirmation. There were the threes. And then, too, there was the name Simon. "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me?" Now, this was Peter's old name. It's the one he possessed before he met Jesus. Remember, Jesus had met him when he said, "You are Simon, son of John, you will be Cephas." The person Jesus first met was light, unstable, weak. His new name meant rock. And Jesus takes a shaky Simon and turns him into a rock-like Peter. Now, there's a very chilling dimension here as Jesus uses his old name in the exchange. Going back to the old name was a reminder of his weakness. The rock Peter had displayed the shakiness of his pre-change days. The use of the name Simon was reminding him that his recent behavior was very, very like a person who didn't know Jesus. There was a follower of Jesus in the courtyard that day, but you would not have known, would you? I wonder if you've been in a situation as a Christian where you would not have been picked out as a Christian because your behavior pointed in a very different direction. Part of Peter's difficulty was that he believed he really was what the new name signified. But apart from the help of Christ in his own strength, have you ever been in that position? Begun to think of the strengths of character that God has developed in you as being your own doing? If so, you will fall. But gentle arousing rather than stern scolding was what Peter needed, and is often what we need too. Perhaps no one else picked up on these subtleties, but when Jesus touches us, inconsequential things to others become important to us. We remember the fire. We remember the extent of our failure. We long for a new opportunity to be reinstated. Jesus speaks in a very personal way when it comes to restoration. So there were the gentle reminders, And then there were the penetrating questions. And they all have the same focus. Do you love me? Love is something that just about everyone understands. Everybody loves somebody or loves something. And Jesus now asks Peter about the focus of his love and about the quality of love. Now, in the exchange, there's a dimension that's not reflected in the English language. And it pertains to the words that are used for love in the Greek. Now, some would argue that since Jesus spoke in Aramaic, not too much should be made of this. However, the fact is that in the context of the Greek language, the Spirit of God has carefully retained for us what we need to know. And coupled with John's ability to use nuances of the Greek language to convey important issues, the distinction in the use of the words for love is not to be missed. Now, two Greek words are used for love. They're the Greek words that nearly all of us know. We're all Greek scholars when it comes to these words. It's the words agapeo and phileo. Agapeo, 100% love, love of the highest and noblest form, love which is deep-seated and thoroughgoing, intelligent and purposeful, more volitional than emotional. And then phileo, you could say 60% love, friendship, deep affection, rapport, spontaneous, natural affection, where the emotions play a larger part than the intellect and will. In the first two questions, as you probably know already, Jesus uses agapeo, but in the third, he uses phileo, the one that Peter replies with all three times. And when Jesus speaks of agape-type love, Peter's reply indicates that he loves his Lord, but not in that way, not as much as that. And when ultimately Jesus changes his word to phileo, he's significantly coming down to Peter's level. Notice the first question. Simon, son of John, do you truly love me? Agape love, do you truly love me more than these? There's a number of ways we can look at this. Jesus could be asking, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these, more than you love these things? The boat, the nets, the lake, the tackle, the fish, everything that represented his old experience. In Peter's reply, he drops a comparison. If he's referring to fishing things, then there would be no problem holding the comparison. And so that's a likely indication that this is not what is meant. Though we can ask ourselves, do we love too much the things of the world? Or is Jesus saying, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than you love these others? More than you love your fishing friends? Probably very unlikely there. Or does he mean, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than your fellow disciples love me? And that's probably most likely. Some commentators don't like the idea of the comparison being made with others, but the context, I think, amplifies why this is done. And to me, without being dogmatic, there's clearly a link being made with Peter's prior claim to be more reliable than them. Matthew 26, Jesus told them, this very night you will all fall away on account of me, for it's written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee. Peter replied, even if all fall away on account of you, I never will. Here he exalts himself above the others. And Jesus had heard these prior claims, and he's probably reminding Peter of them. Peter, is your love really higher and purer than the love of these others? And Peter expresses exactly what he finds in his heart. Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. I really do have love for you, filial love, but not the agape that you're asking for. And he can't bring himself to acknowledge this, that kind of love. His recent actions go against it. But yes, Lord, I do have rapport with you. I am your friend. I do carry quite a bit of sympathy here. How important is honesty with God? Dishonesty with God leads to disaster. Peter's previous boast had exaggerated the true state of his heart. There's no arrogance now. The bubble has been burst. The second question, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me? Again, agape love. So any reference to a comparison is now dropped. Peter can no longer claim to surpass his fellows in loving Christ. Can he still claim to have any kind of genuine love for Jesus at all? Peter sticks to his guns. Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Philia, he's tacitly appealing for the correction of Jesus as needed, if it's needed. Then the third question, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Jesus now uses the word phileo, Peter's word. All reference to love of the agape kind is dropped. Jesus is saying, all right, I've heard what you said, but are you absolutely sure? Is what you're confessing true to fact? And we read in verse 17, Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, do you love me? He said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. In other words, Lord, you know better than I do. You're omniscient. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But I do have genuine affection for you. What was it that caused the hurt the third time? Was it the change of word? Was it the way the question was asked? Was it the look in Jesus' face? Luke did note in his account that at the moment of denial, when the cock crowed, we read, the Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. What a look that must have been. The fact is, the third question was absolutely devastating. Do you love me? Are you my friend? If our recent actions have been in the realm of failure, under the gaze of God's word and spirit, we're not prone to reply using the greatest terminology. We're like Job, who had a lot to say, but then the Lord had spoken, and he said, I'm unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I've no answer. Twice, but I'll say no more. Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. We can only rely on the Lord's understanding of our hearts. We'll not overclaim. That's why I wanted us to sing Psalm 139. Lord, you know I love you. You search me, Lord, you know me. You know when I sit down and rise up. You know when you perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You're familiar with all my ways before a word is on my tongue. Lord, you know it. You hem me in behind and before. You place your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty. I cannot attain to it. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I go flee from your presence? And the sword of the spirit convicts. He lays open. He cuts to the depth of our being. He brings to place the fact that obedience is an indication of our love and discipleship. If we leave a disobedience trail behind us, we're thankful if given a threefold opportunity to affirm our love. It could be painful, but we're thankful for the opportunity. And if you've fallen, if you've denied your Lord, it's only when you discover a real grain of love for Jesus that you're in any position to be recommissioned to do his work. The concern of Christ is in the realm of love. Other qualities may be desirable, but love is completely indispensable. Jesus is concerned about our love rather than the things we do. And genuine repentance, the kind that leads to restoration, has as its first concern how my sin affects God, and only consequentially, how my sin affects me. And the restoration that led Peter to be recommissioned is a kind of restoration that's only sought after in the lives of those who are truly Christ's. The awareness that my backsliding grieves God. I referred to David in the psalm, and he wrote, he restores my soul. And David knew what it was to be restored spiritually. He said, restore to me the joy of my salvation. Why had he lost the joy of his salvation? Because he'd got involved with someone else's wife. Then he tried to cover it up and ended up actually murdering Uriah the Hittite. So David's sin is affecting Bathsheba. It's affecting him. It's affected Uriah. But it was also affecting God. And when he prays to the Lord, he says, I know my transgression, my sin is always before me. He says, against you and you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. He realizes a fundamental thing, that first and foremost, his sin is against God. The cry for restoration that is genuine, I say, Lord Jesus, restore me, no matter how it hurts, no matter what it costs, no matter what it means. There'll be no restoration. We just want to feel better. We ask that the Lord restore us so that he can be working us and so that he can be glorified. Gentle reminders, penetrating questions, and thirdly, new opportunities. Because in response to Peter's threefold confession of love, there's a threefold commission to feed my lambs, take care of my sheep, feed my sheep. And we can learn a lot here about how love should be direct to the service Jesus asks for us. Notice its focus. His own people, the personal pronoun, my lambs, my sheep, says Jesus. He does want us to express our love directly to him. He also wants us to take the next step. It could be more difficult because to love Jesus is one thing. There's no fault in him. To love his sheep is quite another. They sometimes bite even. And Jesus said, this will be the focus, my people. And its scope, not just some of his people, but all of his people. The Lord impresses upon Peter duty both to his lambs and to his sheep. It's covering the whole flock here, every single member, whoever they might be. And if we love Jesus, we've no right to withhold our service from any of our brothers and sisters. And we usually have some folks we know about, we're closer to, and we know the struggles that they're facing. We know the difficult paths they're walking on. And Jesus wants you to take care of them, to love them, and to help them at that point. We use the Lord's Prayer today. It's used each Sunday. The first sentence is incredibly deep. Our Father in heaven. When you say our Father in heaven, you're gathering every other believer into your prayer. And when they use it, they're gathering you into their prayer. So if we're praying our Father in heaven, we've got to love our brothers and sisters. We've got to be serving them. We've got to be taking care of the lambs, feeding the sheep. His people, all his people, and its extent as the situation demands. Shepherd ministers to every need of the sheep. And the result of the caring for the sheep is you'll find joy in seeing them grow, lambs strengthened and nurtured, sheep prone to wander, steadied and anchored. There's a great joy in investing in people's lives. In 1974, I commenced studies for the ministry. I went to Glasgow. I needed to find accommodation. The accommodation wasn't easily found, but I found this lady who had rooms and places that she let, and I committed to one. And the way it worked was you paid every Friday night. And I remember at the time when I went to pay, there was another young man who came and paid, and I got chatting to him. And it turned out that he had recently been converted to Christ from a life of really quite serious crime. And I got to know him quite well. I think eventually the floor collapsed in his flat and he moved to a different one and used to call on him quite regularly. And then I noticed there always seemed to be quite a lot of rough people around in his house. And he was taking them in. He was seeking to win his friends for Christ, and many by the grace of God were one. There's one particular person I remember well. He became a Christian, wonderfully. And in order to nurture him, this person actually took him in to stay with him. He was difficult. He was awkward. I found it difficult to spend just 1 hour in his presence. He took him in. One thing I particularly remember, do you know what it was? He used to make porridge. And if you're in the house, he would come through with this pot of porridge. Well, we'll call it porridge. It was actually more like cement. If I had some today, I'd use it to fill the potholes in the roads. But it was like cement. But he was being cared for. He was being nourished and nurtured. Eventually, I left Glasgow. As happens, you lose touch with people. 30 years later, the church I was serving at that time agreed to host a missionary conference. And I went along, and I listened to quite a few missionary reports. One of those reporting just seemed a bit familiar. There was something about his voice. I couldn't put my finger on it. And later that day, it dawned on me. It was a porridge maker from Glasgow. He is a missionary team leader in another part of the world, a very sensitive part of the world. You notice I've mentioned no names here. I don't want that going online. But here's this young roughneck from Glasgow. And the result of that brother's feeding and taking care of him, a solid Christian is there who once was very unstable. I know probably many others have come to faith in other parts of the world because this person nurtured the lambs, cared for the sheep, reached out to him in his need and did things that I considered to be amazing. Peter's not restored to uselessness, to usefulness. One of the fears you can have, and I've sometimes had it, am I still going to be useful? Lord, I want to be useful in some way. And Peter, well, his usefulness is seen in the book of Acts. His usefulness, well, we benefit from the epistles he wrote, don't we? And God will make us useful. Useful to loved ones. Useful to people around us. Useful to the church fellowship. Useful to God. Experience of restoration, forgiveness is needed if we be fishers of men. Some of us may be floundering today, just a bit shaky, and Jesus, the risen Lord in our midst, might be saying, do you love me? And you say, yes, Lord, hesitantly, I do love you. And he draws us, and he says, do you take care of my lambs? Feed your sheep. I'll make you useful. Dear children, let us not love with words or the tongue, but with actions and in truth. Jesus alone is worthy of all the love of our hearts. We love him because he first loved us. And when we're loving Jesus and serving him, things are well. It's when we stop, they're not. Let's spend a few moments of quietness before we sing our closing song.